Let's begin then with the words that everyone says in their hearts as we are waiting for Bible class to start. 'Tis good, Lord, to be here. Thy glory fills the night. Thy face and garments like the sun shine with unborrowed light. 'Tis good, Lord, to be here. Thy beauty to behold where Moses and Elijah stand, thy messengers of old. Fulfiller of the past and hope of things to be, we hail thy body glorified and our redemption see. Before we taste of death, we see thy kingdom come. We long to hold the vision bright and make this hill our home. 'Tis good, Lord, to be here, yet we may not remain. But since thou bidst us leave the mount, come with us to the plain. Amen. So we are going to be shipwrecked today with Paul. And we recall a few lessons ago, we understood how Paul had been converted. Is it accurate to say that Paul was converted on the road to Damascus?
The conversion took a little longer than that.
We might say he was converted on the road to Damascus, because as he had been an enemy of Jesus' doctrine and understood Jesus' doctrine, which is why he rejected it. Remember, the Pharisees believed you had to do your part, and Jesus was teaching it was a pure gift. And if you believe that you have to do your part, and someone is teaching it's a free gift, they're dangerous. Because if people believe it's a free gift, they won't be doing their part, and they'll be damned. And that's why it was important to get rid of Jesus. In their minds, he was teaching a false doctrine. But of course he wasn't. He was teaching the doctrine that can be found also in the Old Testament, but that many of the Jews had wandered off from. So Saul understood Jesus' doctrine and rejected it. And that's why he was persecuting the church. When Jesus appears to him on the Damascus Road and says, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It is difficult to kick against the goads." What must Paul have realized? I was wrong. And if I was wrong, it means who was right? He was right. So one might say that he was converted, but when was he born again? Well, instruction is part of it. When he was baptized. Born again, no one can enter the kingdom of God unless he is born again of water and the Spirit. Flesh gives birth to flesh, and spirit gives birth to spirit. So we have a converted Saul who is now operating under the apostolic name of Paul. And Paul is an apostle to the Gentiles. When he meets with Peter and the gang in Jerusalem, they have it divvied up that the apostles are to the Jews, and to Saul or Paul is the apostle to the Gentiles. And during this ministry of Paul, we know of in Acts at least three missionary journeys that Paul engaged in. So there were three times he went out into different parts of the world to preach the gospel, and he did it with much success. By church tradition, it's possible that he had more missionary journeys than are recorded, because to the Romans, St. Paul said that it's always his plan to go to Spain. And as of this writing, he hasn't been to Spain yet. And there's some traditions that say he went to Spain. But in our text here, Paul is going to be shipwrecked, but he's not shipwrecked on a missionary journey, and we'll provide the context for his shipwreck when we get back to the beginning. But now let's go from beginning to end in our text. We're looking at excerpts from Acts 27 through 28. Versification is indicated, and gaps in the text are indicated with dots. Chapter 27. And when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment, So entering a ship of Andramatium, we put to sea, But not long after, a tempestuous headwind arose called Euroclydon. So when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive. And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship. Now when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. Then Paul stood in the midst of them and said, "There stood by me this night an angel of the Lord, to whom I belong and whom I serve, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar, and indeed God has granted you all those who sail with you. Therefore, take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told me.' When it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they observed a bay with a beach, onto which they planned to run the ship if possible. And the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wanting to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land, and the rest, some on boards and some on parts of the ship. And so it was that they all escaped safely to land. Now when they had escaped, they then found out that the island was called Malta, and the natives showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and made us all welcome because of the rain that was falling and because of the cold. But when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. They said to one another, 'No doubt this man is a murderer, whom though he has escaped the sea, yet justice does not allow to live.' But he shook off the creature into the fire and suffered no harm. However, they were expecting that he would swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But after they had looked for a long time and saw no harm come to him, they changed their mind and said he was a god. They also honored us in many ways, and when we departed, they provided such things as were necessary." So this is at the near the end of Acts, and the three missionary journeys recorded have already taken place, and Paul is a prisoner, and we ask ourselves, how in the world did he get incarcerated? And if we were to look at the history in Acts, it tells us at one point Paul is in Jerusalem and he's in and near the temple, and there are some that come and make accusations about him, and there develops a riot in Jerusalem, to which the Roman soldiers come in and quote unquote rescue Paul because they were about to tear him to pieces. Besides this, what had they done to Stephen before Paul? Yeah, they had taken him out and stoned him. And we would expect no better treatment and probably far worse treatment at the hands of the Jews for Paul. So he's taken into custody and eventually is taken up into Caesarea Philippi, which is up north, another imperial city. And there Paul languishes uncharged and untried. And there are various changes in Roman government and governors, so there's confusion about Paul. And Paul has an opportunity during this imprisonment to confess Jesus to the Roman governor in such a compelling way that Governor Festus said to him, "I'm almost persuaded to become as you are." And Paul says to him, "I wish you would become as I am, except for these chains maybe." So Paul apparently becomes impatient. And we remember about Paul that he's unique in that he's also a Roman citizen, right? Jesus was not a Roman citizen. The disciples, the others, were not Roman citizens. But Paul, coming from Asia Minor and eventually moving to Jerusalem, has Roman citizenship through his father. And when it's found out he's a Roman citizen, he gets a little better treatment, a little different treatment, and he appeals to his right as a Roman citizen and appeals to Caesar, which means he has the right of appeal to the Supreme Court of the land. And the Supreme Court is Caesar. And when he says he appeals to Caesar, Festus says, "You appeal to Rome, and to Rome you shall go." And they didn't have trains, planes, and automobiles in the day. So Paul is a prisoner on the prison ship when they experience this shipwreck. And we know from the season that they're going in the winter, when the season is not good for ship travel, it's treacherous. And Paul has some premonitions or some inspirations that it isn't a well-advised trip, and he warns them. And the centurion that eventually sort of advocates for Paul being spared in our text is the one that Paul is telling these things to. You know, he's warning him about a treacherous journey, and sure enough, the journey is treacherous. So let's go through the text. "And when it was decided that we should sail to Italy..." Now here's another grammatical feature in the book of Acts. At a certain point of Acts, it switches to the pronoun we. Who's we? Luke. Luke the author. So Luke is telling this from his perspective. We know that Luke was accompanied Paul at least on the third missionary journey. And why would he have needed a physician on his missionary journey? Well, he had bad eyes, as he reports to the Galatia in this Galatian epistle. But also, we know that he was stoned and left for dead at a city in Asia Minor in his first missionary journey. So it is likely Paul had some troubles. And no doubt it was the Lord who provided a good physician to go with him and a believer. Pardon? Needed someone to treat the snake bite. I'd never thought of that. I wonder if Luke went in there and, you know, drew the X with his penknife and sucked the poison out. I don't know that they did that back then. They did a lot of amazing things in their medicines. You know, they found ancient Roman physician tools that date B.C., before Christ, that they proposed were a method that the physicians could treat cataract. They had this thing where they would slice open the eye, and then it was a sucking tube, and they would suck the cataract out and then flip the lens. You guys that still spend the big bucks on the History Channel, they have lots of documentaries like that. They had ways of relieving pressure on the mind, you know, when people had brain aneurysms that leaked. They would open up the skull and let it bleed. They knew a lot more than we think. They just didn't have computers and technology like we did. And to tell you the truth, I don't know if I'd want them doing that with me. Shows anyone will do anything to avoid death, even consult the physicians. So they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. So entering a ship of Andramitium, we put to sea. Verse 14. I think it's a type of ship. I think it's a class of ships. Or of a certain fleet. We put to sea, but not long after, a tempestuous headwind arose called Eurycladon. Now, some translations call it a nor'eastern. And so you know how they sailors have names, usually women's names for these events that happen. What is it in the Edmund Fitzgerald when the witch of something arises? Gordon Lightfoot sings. So when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive. And so that's the traditional way of facing a storm, to get the bow facing into the waves and the wind and to try to slice through it by the shape of the ship. So when they could not head into the wind, we let her drive. In other words, to keep the wind from tearing the ship apart, they went in the direction of the wind and let the boat drive. Not opposing the momentum, but keeping the ship in the momentum of the wind and the storm. And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship. And of course that means that to keep from sinking and to sit higher on the water, they let loose the ballast. Did they have cannons back then? I don't know. They had catapults. I know that some of the ships had catapults and that sort of thing. So they probably waited, they threw overboard whatever munitions they had and whatever was non-essential to lighten the load. Verse 21, then Paul stood in the midst of them. When? He stood in the midst when they had given up all hope. Why does he wait until that time in order to speak with them? Exactly. As long as people have hope, what do people do? They argue about a solution. They say, this is the way that we must go. And the other guy says, no, 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 this is the way that we must go. And when they're at loggerheads and they prove to each other that neither of the solutions will work, and when they are in despair, it is a teachable moment. So long as a person is confident in their own ability, the chances are they won't listen. Look at the politicians that disagree. Do they listen to one another? Absolutely not. And if we were so flexible as to stand in the shoes of each of them and to listen to their case and then to stand in the shoes of the other, we would maybe find ourselves agreeing to whatever case we heard put to us, because in their mind they are compelling. But what happens when there are two political factions that cannot seek compromise and will not listen to each other? It's hopeless. It's destructive. The whole citizenry becomes nervous because there is no leadership. Now, who should be the leader of everybody's life? Who should everyone be listening to and shut up and listen? God. Do people do that? No, we had it in the text today. Simon had his idea of what Jesus ought to do. Was he convinced that it was a bad plan for Jesus to go and die on the cross? Of course. And why was it a bad plan? He loved Jesus. He loved him. Would you want anyone you love to go through those things? Of course not. But his love for Jesus, the major thing in that text. No, Peter can be stuck with that love of Jesus and he'll go to hell. Because what kind of Jesus does he want to live or want to love? He wants to love a living Jesus, not one that dies on the cross. And what kind of future does Peter have if he has a Jesus that won't die on the cross? He may love him, but he'll go to hell with that love. Because Jesus has to die on the cross to save Peter. He has to die on the cross. When are people's hearts and ears open to the gospel? When they run out of hope in themselves. So long as people place their hope and confidence in themselves, they will not place it in Jesus. And this is why we preach the law. We warn all believers, don't put trust in yourself. If you do, you will fail. That's why we preach the law to the world, to turn them from their trust in themselves, to understand that they will die and there's nothing they can do about it, and that they will face the judgment of God and there is nothing they can do about it. So that in that despair, they'll shut up. And shutting up, maybe God will say something to them that will save them, called the gospel. That's why our theology is shaped in that way, law and then the gospel. This is the shape of the story that we have in front of us. Law. What's the law? The storm is driving them to death. They know that ships get wrecked on the Mediterranean and they disappear and they're never seen again. And they are afraid that's going to happen to them. And there is nothing they can do about it. The best laid and proposed plans of the captain of the ship and all of the experienced sailors despair. We've tried to lighten the load. We've tried turning to the wind. We've turned tail into the wind. We've done everything that we can, and there is no hope. And then Paul stands up and speaks. Because as many of you wise people went cut to the chase with me and gave the bottom line, that I finally caught up with you bright people, because now they'll listen. Now they'll listen. Does this give us insight why in the Old West, before they hung the prisoner, they sent the priest in to see him? They still do that on death row. There's a marvelous book I read, and I think I lent it out to someone because I don't have it anymore. Either that or I misplaced it. That's possible too. But there's a book out by a Missouri Synod chaplain in World War II that was chosen to be one of two clergymen who would work with the Nazi principals of prisoners in Nuremberg. And we're talking about these bigwigs like Himmler and Goring. So they had a Catholic priest and this Missouri Synod chaplain. And in the last 10 years or so, he wrote a book, wonderful book. Was that good or bad that there was chaplains available to these Nazi war criminals that did the worst things in the world? People got mad at him for doing it. They deserve to die and go to hell. Is that true? Absolutely. But then so do you and I. And do you think it was possibly a teachable moment? And for some it was. And there was one of them, I think it was Goring, I'm not remembering well, who actually had opposed him for a long time. And the night before he was going to get called to be killed, he asked for Holy Communion. And our Missouri Synod chaplain refused him. Why? He was doing it for superstitious purpose. Oh, what harm could it do? Could it have done him harm?
Yes.
Yeah. He refused him. It really is a good read. I'm sorry I can't. You'll have to search for it on the internet, and you can find anything on the internet. You'll find it.
Mission at Nuremberg.
Mission at Nuremberg. Remember the author by any chance?
Gerke.
Thank you so much, good brother. Thank you. Did you read it?
Yeah, I lent it to you.
No, I confess. Talk about ingratitude. He lent it to me, and I implied someone stole it from me. I sit shamefaced and, again, doubly grateful. Thank you, good brother. And I hope if CPH still has it, it's one I would recommend reading, right?
It's a great read.
It is a great read. Did I get any of my facts wrong about it?
No, you're
oh, okay. All right. I need all the help I can get these days. Yes.
Speaking of finding books, I have to check. Are there any books in the locked closet across from the office that are so important that they have to be locked? Or could we be trusted to browse? And if we see one we want, list our names somewhere?
See what? See, Lorraine is getting me on this because I hold the office of the keys. And she believes I have a key to that cabinet.
Does anybody?
But I don't. Cheryl does.
Well, why does it have to be locked?
I don't know. I will, if I remember, and you can remind me because I forget.
I mean, unless there's something in there that is just so bad.
No, I agree with you. We should have it open and available. I think at one time when that was first developed, and that was probably 25 years ago or 20
years ago,
50 years ago, the idea is that people would check out a book so that we wouldn't lose it.
Well, we haven't lost any.
We accomplished our goal, but maybe the goal you're pointing out is we should have the goal that people read them. If I remember on Monday morning at our staff meeting, I will ask the keeper of those keys to open it up. Yes. Thank you. See, this is why we should have a suggestion box somewhere down here. All right, let's go. Verse 20. All hope that we would be saved was finally given up. Then Paul stood in the midst of them and said, there stood by me this night an angel of God to whom I belong and whom I serve, saying, do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you. Therefore, take heart, men, for I believe that God, that it will be just as it was told me. So let's look at what Paul is saying here. He's a prisoner. He is a victim of all the decisions that the prisoner keepers, the prison guards, are imposing on him. He has to do everything they say, and they're in charge. Now in this shipwreck, the angel comes to Paul, and Paul reports what the angel says to him. There stood by me this night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve. Paul is here confessing, I don't belong to you. You think I'm under your justice system and you are making the decisions or the courts are making a decision. What's going to happen to me? But it's not true. I don't belong to you. I belong to God. Do we also belong to God? How did we become his property? Does Scripture say he bought us and we belong to him? Yes. He has redeemed me, which means bought me back, not with gold or silver, but with his holy precious blood, and with his innocent suffering and death, that I may be my own, no, that I may be his own, and live under him in his kingdom, and serve him in everlasting righteousness, innocence, and blessedness. Do you belong to God, or do you belong to yourself, or do you belong to the devil? Those are the choices. There are no free agents. And if you belong to yourself, you belong to the devil. Because that's what he believes too. to whom I belong and whom I serve. He learned the second article of Luther's explanation of the creed. He learned it. We know it. We're with Paul. Saying, do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. So whose decision is it that Paul is going to appear before Caesar? God's decision. And nothing's going to stop it. In fact, this whole convoluted story about Paul being arrested and eventually going to Rome is not Paul, the victim of the winds of chance and history. It is God forming history. You are here not by your choice, but because you belong to God and he has brought you here to hear his word. It was his decision. Because he loves you and he wants to speak with you. And evidently he loves Caesar, or at least someone in Caesar's household, because he's sending an apostle to Caesar, the highest station, humanly speaking, in the Roman Empire. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So whom has God given the soldiers and everyone in the boat? Who has God given them to? Paul. Who's in charge? Who speaks for the Lord? Who says what is going to happen? Is Paul doing this in order to gain a following for himself?
Yeah.
He's relating to them what God has said. All this is happening and you're still alive because God wants me to go to Caesar. And it will happen. And here's the benefit to you. You are all in my hand, which means when I declare that God will keep you safe, I am taking care of you with God's word. And you will be safe because God has granted you to me. And as you heed my word, you belong to me. Your ears are enslaved to me. You must listen to me. And again, is this a humanistic statement of Paul or a divine statement? God gave me this word, and your ears are slave to God. You must listen to his word. And are they saying yes or no? Yeah, we're dying here. We have no hope. And you're telling us from God that we have a hope. It's the only hope we got. Yeah, I'm going to listen. Law first. And then the gospel. 25, encouragement. Therefore, take heart, men. Be encouraged. You're not going to die. I guarantee it. You're not going to die. And this is not superstition, because it's a word from God. Take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told me. And so he says, whether you believe it or not, I'm confident. And you would do well to believe it too. A marvelous witness to dying men by a living apostle. Verse 39. When it was day, they did not recognize the land. Okay, so it's been dark. The clouds haven't seen sun, moon, or stars. It became day. They saw the land. Didn't recognize it. Where are we? But they observed a bay with a beach, onto which they planned to run the ship, if possible. And the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away and escape. Anyone have any insight why this was the soldiers' plan? Yeah, if the prisoners escaped, the Roman government was big on responsibility, and they held people that were responsible responsible. So the soldiers, the prison keepers, would be responsible for those prisoners and would have to pay whatever penalty that they owed to justice. So if there were murderers, and no doubt there were, on the ship that they escaped, what could the prison guards expect from Roman justice? The death penalty. Remember the jailer in Philippi when the earth shook and the chains fell off the prisoners and the door cells swung open. The jailer at Philippi was about to fall on his sword and kill himself. And Paul had to say, no, no, don't kill yourself. We're all here. So it was a reasonable plan to kill the prisoners. After all, they're just prisoners anyway, right? But the centurion, the guy in charge, wanting to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded. He had the word of authority. He commanded them that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to the land, and the rest, some on boards and some on parts of the ship. And so it was that they all escaped safely to land. So on the flotsam and jetsam that was resultant from the storm, they all went with their little floating pieces of wood and went onto the shore. And of course, I suppose the temptation for desperate prisoners might be just to swim off into the sea. Maybe face their chances on the sea, but none of them did that because they had land. And so they were, even if they were desperate, they would take their chances on land. Verse 28, or chapter 28, verse 1. Now when they had escaped, that means the ship. When they had gotten all to land, they then found out that the island was called Malta, and we can still find it on the maps. We know where Malta is. Any of you world travelers ever been to Malta? I know some have taken cruises. Have you been to Malta? Any insights? Did you get to see the beach where they told you? No? Usually when you go to a place mentioned in the Bible, there's always a place that, believe it or not, that's probably where it happened. You didn't get stung by any vipers while you were... No. And the natives showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and made us welcome because of the rain that was falling and because of the cold. So just as the Indians befriended the pilgrims at the first Thanksgiving, we have the Maltesians. What do you call the people from Malta? Maltans. The Maltans take pity on these shipwrecked people. And can you imagine how they looked? They had been running in a storm for days and days. No doubt they had grabbed something to eat when they could, but it's pretty hard to serve people on a ship that's bowing around in the ocean like that. They must have looked absolutely grizzled and careworn. And the Maltans, when they saw them, felt pity on them. The weather was still bad, rainy and cold, and so they lit them fire on the beach or in their village. But when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hands. So the viper is hiding amongst the wood. It's cold, so maybe this cold-blooded beast is sort of nestled on a piece of wood to keep as warm as he can and out of the rain. But when the wood is put by the fire, it becomes enthused or energized and comes out and attaches himself to Paul's hand. So you can see, you know, the viper has bit him, and he's on his hand. So when the natives saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said one to another, "No doubt this man is a murderer, whom though he has escaped from the sea, yet justice does not allow to live." So what did the Maltesians believe? Well, karma, what comes around goes around. Bad things, people that do bad things ought to have bad things happen to them. Is that true? Yeah, it's called justice. And Paul kind of was a murderer. He approved of Stephen's being stoned. Is God less of a God when he imposes justice on people? Or is justice one of God's essential attributes? It is one of his attributes. Is God sinning when he sends hardened sinners to hell? No, he's being just. Now, if he were just to me, he would also send me to hell. I take hope in him not only being just, but also merciful. Now, all religions, including whatever religions the Maltesians practiced, believe in justice, and all believe in mercy. And all of them give a way in which you can flip God from being just and angry with you to being merciful. I don't know if Malta has a volcano, but on islands with volcanoes, they throw a virgin in once a year. Why? To appease God's justice so that he'll be merciful to them for another year. It ain't funny if you're a virgin. Only in America, not in the Polynesian islands. Every false teaching in Christianity comes from the same thing. When Catholics demand that you do good works in order to be saved, they're saying Jesus did his part in appeasing God's justice, but you have to also do your part and your penance. And if you don't, you won't flip God. Only in biblical Christianity do we find a God who is equally just and merciful at the same time and doesn't need to flip because he's equally just and merciful. And that's the revelation that we have in Christ on the cross. And that's why it's the center of our religion, and it is the ultimate revelation of God. In Jesus' cross, God is just and punishes my every sin, which Jesus bore for me. And if I don't have him, I will bear that sin forever in hell. And even as God is showing his justice in punishing my sin, he is equally showing his mercy, because Jesus is dying in my place out of love for me. I don't flip God, I find God, who is both just and merciful. The Maltesians see that he's being punished, so he must be under God's justice. And that is a truth of their religion. But when he is bitten by the viper and does not die, what is Paul illustrating, or what is being illustrated in Paul?
Grace.
God's mercy. He should die, but because of his God, he doesn't. And that's an opportunity for Paul to preach to the Maltans. I wonder if they drink malted milk. But it's their opportunity to speak to them the gospel of Jesus Christ, the revelation of God, in which God is equally just and merciful.
Is viper just another word for snake, or is a viper always poisonous?
It's a poisonous viper. It's also this really hot Dodge car. But don't get stung by that thing either. Do they make that anymore? I think Dodge stopped making the viper. Do they still sell the Crossfire?
No.
There's still the Mustang, right?
Yeah, that's it.
However, they were expecting that he would swell up or suddenly fall dead, but after they had looked for a long time and saw no harm come to him, they changed their mind and said that he was a god. And again, this is bad. This is not the first time that he got mistaken for being a god, and he no doubt chasten them for making that assumption. But what are they saying? They have a divine revelation. they are being given a revelation of God in St. Paul. And of course, it is not stated, but we know he must have preached to them, made that the opportunity to preach for them. And verse 10, they also honored us in many ways, and when we departed, they provided such things as were necessary. They sent them on their way. And so ends the 100 Bible stories. Oh, yeah, the ship is wrecked. They found another passage.